Did Thomas Jefferson intend the whitewashing of the public square? That is, no God, no Bible, nothing like that allowed in the public arena. We're going to talk about that right now with David Barton, who is a walking encyclopedia on America's true history, America's Christian roots. His website is wallbuilders.org, and he's written a book called The Jefferson Lies, which has recently been revised and has overcome some of the controversy surrounding the first edition. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do it, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now, recently we had the presidential inauguration come and pass, and we see some of the militant atheist groups saying, oh, no, no, don't allow the Bible, in the inauguration. What would Jefferson say about that, since Jefferson is the one from whom the Supreme Court ultimately brought into the interpretation of the First Amendment the idea that the Establishment Clause meant there should be this strict separation of church and state? At least that's the way some interpret Jefferson, and I want you to wax eloquent. Did Jefferson want a naked public square, so to speak?
Well, one of the things we can do is say actions speak louder than words. The Supreme Court says Jefferson said this, but they really don't get around deciding what Jefferson actually said. So we have actually two things going here. One is Jefferson's actions completely dispute what the court says, and number two, Jefferson's words dispute what the court says. It's just the court won't quote his words. They quote eight words out of a 233-word letter, and they rest it there. So let's go back to inauguration. We just had the inauguration, the very first inauguration done by George Washington, clearly a constitutional expert. The inauguration was planned by Congress, and one-fourth of the members of Congress had been delegates to the Constitutional Convention. So we have a very constitutionally literate Congress. And they included 14 ministers, both Christian ministers and rabbis, in planning that inauguration. Washington's inauguration included eight separate religious events in the inauguration, eight separate displays of religion throughout the inauguration. And guess what? Every presidential inauguration since has included all or part of those, and that includes Thomas Jefferson's inauguration, filled with religious activities, including him calling for prayer during his inaugural address. All sorts of things that would send the atheist secularist off today. So as far as the inauguration goes, Jefferson had no difficulty with religious activities because he included that. That was part of what he did. He was part of Jefferson. He was part of George Washington's original inauguration, if you will, because he was Secretary of State. So already we've got a real dispute between history and what the critics say. And then as you move through his presidential administration, you certainly see that he did not believe in the naked public square without religion. He is the guy that back in 1800 had helped facilitate the start of church services at the U.S. Capitol inside the hall of the House of Representatives. For 3 months as vice president, he went to church inside the Capitol at the church he had helped facilitate. And then for the next 8 years and 2 terms as president, he also went to church there. And he even invited preachers in to preach the Sunday services at the church at the Capitol. That clearly is not the Jefferson we're told about today. And I can just go through a litany of other documented activities he did that do not comport with the way that we're told Jefferson wanted a naked public square.
All right, good. And I'll ask you about that litany in a few moments. But let's go back to the inauguration ceremonies, if we could. You mentioned that there were eight religious elements that were there in the very first of the inaugurations, and many of them have continued to this very day. Can you delineate those? What are you talking about?
Yeah, as you go through the events, the first thing that happened is, as reported by the papers in New York, and New York was the federal capital for the first year there, was they had the people, they rang bells throughout the city at 9 a.m. that morning, and all the people went to church and gathered for prayer. And as they noted in the papers, it's a time designed, quote, holy for prayer. This is not a sermon time. This is a time to pray. Then George Washington's inauguration.
Can I stop you real fast? I just want you to know, I just was scanning through several of the first inaugural addresses of several of our different presidents, and I was struck by the statement Reagan made that I think the day of inauguration should be a national day of prayer. But go on. Go back to Washington.
Well, the second one is really kind of in many ways related to, well, it's just a religious tone. So you start with people gathering for prayer across the city. The second thing is Washington goes to the inauguration. He's sworn in on the balcony of Federal Hall. At that point, he's sworn in on a Bible, 1767 King James Bible. They open it at random. It opened to Genesis 49. He takes an oath on the Bible. He then swears the oath. He then leans over and kisses the Bible. And by the way, interestingly enough, at that point in time, as you look at the 13 colonies, throughout the 13 colonies, they all prescribed the means of oath-taking. And in oath-taking, you were to say, so help me God. You are to put your hand on the Bible. Many of the states said you don't just put your hand on the Bible. It said you put your hand on the book of the holy evangelist of Almighty God. In other words, the Christian version, the Christian Bible. And then you swear an oath, and then you kiss the Bible. So Washington did that. After that, he went inside from the swearing in. He went inside off the balcony to the Senate chamber in Federal Hall, and he delivered his inaugural address, which he has a prayer in his own inaugural address. He said, in this, my first official act, it would be particularly improper not to pray, and so he has a prayer. And then he also calls on the people to pray, and he has huge amount of religious content through his address. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he closes it with a prayer. And then, according to the records of Congress, the House and Senate had agreed on the next activity. And the next activity was, as soon as he finishes that address, they are going en masse to church at St. Paul's Chapel, where they're to hear divine services. So Congress and the President march a few blocks to St. Paul's Chapel. They go inside, and the service is performed by the Right Reverend Samuel Provost, who the week before had been chosen the chaplain of the Senate. He's the Episcopal Bishop of New York. He gave the lesson that day. It was out of several passages. It was out of Psalms 144 through Psalms 150. It was out of 1 Kings. It was out of the book of Acts. And so then they have their services, and then Reverend Provost leads them in prayer. And then they leave the church together and march back to the Capitol, where that they adjourn for the day. So your activities include calling the people together for prayer, using religious acknowledgments in the oath, particularly leaning over and kissing the Bible to show his reverence for the book. Then he has his inaugural address, where he opens with prayer. He then calls the people to prayer. He then has religious content. He then closes with prayer. And then they all go to church together, and then they have prayers led by clergy at the church. So those are the eight events that you can point to in George mm-hmm. Washington's inaugural address, and those in many ways are still kept through to this day, at least many of them are, not always everyone. The president doesn't always lean over and kiss the Bible now as in former days, but in so many of those activities, it was Washington who set the precedent, and it was followed for generations thereafter, including with Thomas Jefferson.
And if I could just add one thing real fast, at St. Paul's Chapel there, where they had the 2-hour Christian worship service to dedicate the new nation to God, that included Holy Communion, the Lord's table. So they celebrated that. And in fact, years later, when there was some controversy about Washington and communion and so forth, the widow of Alexander Hamilton said, I saw George Washington receive communion, and that was there at that inauguration. But let's get back to Jefferson, since it was in Jefferson's name that unfortunately we have this separation of church and state doctrine, the way it's come to be interpreted. I don't think you even would agree with this, wouldn't you? That separating the church from the institution of the state, that's a good thing. The founders agree with that. The Bible agrees with that. It's not that that's the problem. It's when people distort that and essentially separate God from the state. That's something we don't agree with, and the founders certainly wouldn't agree with, including Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, I am a huge supporter of separation church and state, as the Bible defined it, and as history demonstrates it, and as the founding fathers supported it. And you hit it exactly right, Jerry. It is the institutional separation. You do not separate God or religious expressions or any of the faith elements. As a matter of fact, that's why we just went through all of those elements related to inaugurations. That was never separated. What you did was you made sure you did not have a state-established church. And the phrase, the letter that has the phrase that Jefferson used about separation of church and state was exactly in that regard. It was the Danbury Baptists, afraid that the Congregationalists and the government was run by the Congregationalists, that they were going to tell the Baptists how to express their faith. And Jefferson said, no, there's a separation of church and state. We don't let the government tell you how to practice your faith. unless you're alive today, and then we'll tell you that you can't practice it at football games, and you can't practice it with nativity scenes in the park, and you can't practice it at graduations, and now we've got the government telling us where we can and can't practice our faith. Are you kidding? That's exactly why the Founding Fathers supported separation of church and state, to keep the government from regulating public religious activities. That's the separation of church and state I totally support. It's not in the government's bailiwick to tell us when, where, and how to express our faith, and that's what Thomas Jefferson is a huge advocate of.
All right, since you're familiar.
Let me say that differently. And that's what Thomas Jefferson also opposed. He wanted free expression of religion, and that's why he used that phrase. And since 1947, the Supreme Court has not one time quoted the full Jefferson letter. Again, only 233 words. They quote 8 words out of that letter, a wall of separation between church and state, and then they define it the way they want it rather than the way that he defined it in that very clearly written letter.
Okay, let me ask you this. How does that very clearly written letter end? And the reason I'm asking is, it's the part where he's saying, basically, you pray for me and I'll pray for you, to God.
Yeah.
You know, these. Here he is writing to these Baptists in Connecticut, and comment on that, because that's very significant. Here he is, the President of the United States, asking for prayer to God Almighty in the very source that gives us the supposed separation of church and state, which is now interpreted to mean that, hey, you know, state officials shouldn't even be talking about God, and certainly not talking to God.
Well, it's even worse than that, Jerry. Not only does he, as he said, reciprocate their prayers, because they said they're praying for him, and you have to recall that the Baptists in those days, who we would consider to be the evangelicals, they were the most ardent supporters of Thomas Jefferson, not against. They supported him because the Baptists were a religious minority in every state, and Jefferson was out fighting for the rights of Baptists and Methodists and Quakers and anybody that was a religious minority. He did not want a state-established church. So he gets all these letters from Baptist ministers and groups, and they're praying for him, and they're thanking God that he's elected, etc. And so he said, I receive your prayers, and I reciprocate my prayers for you. And he has this prayer at the end. But that letter, the Separation Church and State letter that everybody likes to quote, was written on January the 1st, 1802. Now, that is a Friday, January the 1st, 1802. 2 days later is Sunday, January the 3rd, 1802. And on that Sunday, Thomas Jefferson arranged for the Reverend John Leland to preach the service at the U.S. Capitol, 2 days after he wrote that letter. Now, so if he's really writing the Separation Church and State, I want a secular public square, then please tell me why 2 days later he invites a prominent preacher from New England who had been his very close friend when he fought against the state-established church, the Anglican Church in Virginia. He invites that preacher, John Leland, to preach the Sunday morning service at the U.S. Capitol, the church he helped facilitate, and he's there with the preacher. People forget that fact as well. He wrote this letter, and 2 days later he has a preacher preaching at the Capitol. No, the secularization of church and state is not what Jefferson wanted. He wanted to make sure the government could not run the church and tell it what to do, when, where, and how.
That's right. And we're basically out of time, but there's example after example of that in your book, The Jefferson Lies. Again, David Barton, thank you so much for being with us. Wallbuilders.org for more information. God bless you, sir.
Thanks, Jerry. Great to be with you. God bless.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.